This is tape number 4 of Libby's Monument, a dream tale of Goblin, by James Beattie, read by Goblin, and by some fortuitous circumstance. The last tape ended with the end of the prologue, and so this tape begins with the beginning of the second part. Libby's Monument, the dream. The police were having a big party upstairs, so our basement party was truly an underground affair. The law enforcement situation upstairs, which I never actually saw but only heard about, reminded me of the district attorney convention described by Dr. Hunter S. Thompson in his book Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I kept imagining the cops up there in terms of Ralph Steadman's grotesque and unsavory illustrations for that tome. Of course, his basement seems an odd place for people like me to be partying, but maybe it was a wise strategic location after all, because this way, should the authorities decide to brand our little gathering as being politically correct, perhaps the FBI would hesitate to burn our house down, as was done in Waco, Texas, on account of all those cops swarming in its upper regions. Even the symbolism was nice, especially for a would-be underground artist like myself. But the arrangements also presented at least one challenging disadvantage for me, anyway. As things turned out, this wasn't the kind of dream where I ultimately woke up needing to cope with a full bladder, but I was having bladder problems in the dream anyway, because the basement I was in had no sanitary facilities, at least no conventional ones. The only bathrooms were upstairs amidst all those cops. I don't know precisely what any other basement partygoers were doing about it, but I, for one, was actually afraid to go up there. Guess those pesky Steadman illos had me really spooked. Trouble was that I was, for some reason, sopping beer up almost by the bucket full, and so needed to piss almost constantly, almost continually. My salvation finally presented itself in the form of a giant empty Bugler tobacco can off in a dark corner. I don't know where it came from nor why it was so big. I actually had to climb a small ladder to reach the top. I also don't know why it was already half full of urine, since nobody was using it but me. Fortunately, it was more waterproof than any ordinary such can would be. But despite any misgivings I may have harbored in my mind, I was kind of sheepishly and furtively draining myself into this strange vessel on a regular basis, though nobody else seemed to notice this, nor even to be aware of the big can itself. I'm a regular piss pot pee, I thought sardonically, wondering why I didn't just pour the beer in there instead and have done with it. I wondered too why only I could see this giant urine receptacle. Could it be that everyone else was only politely ignoring the situation in order to avoid embarrassing me? That seemed almost too polite. And I wondered now if maybe the cops had put the can there to collect a giant urine specimen for their stupid drug tests. In any event, Such questions remained unanswered. I finally got sick of the big damn stinking thing myself and decided forthwith to distance myself from it. To that end, I opened the duffel bag I so often carry around and broke out my always handy Goblin Hood gear. As any Goblin Hood devotee must surely know by now, this basically consists of a full-headed, handmade black cloth mask tied tightly on with a pre-tied necktie and sporting a colorful painted spider instead of a face and a purple and gold Marson Harmlessness sigil on the forehead. It can hardly need to be stated that this mask is what bothers people so much about Goblin Hood. They can't seem to handle supposedly not knowing what he really looks like. He really looks like the mask. Take that away and he's not Goblin Hood anymore. Still, to offset people's negative reactions as a sop to their tender sensibilities, Goblin Hood places a lot of dependence on his trusty clip-on ID card, which he always puts on before the mask, as was the case here. The card has his picture painted on it, along with information meant to explain how harmless he is, such as that he's a harmless space-time phenomenon, and, just to be upfront about everything, that he's an artificial life form, which should be very reassuring considering how dangerous real life forms on this planet, particularly the humanoid variety, so often turn out to be. On this occasion, GH was also packing his spiffy blue cape, which also helps offset negative reactions by making him look more theatrical, I guess, and hence, for some hapless observers at least, more understandable or more easily categorizable or something. As I put all this stuff on and tightened the necktie, I couldn't help hoping that Goblin Hood could hold his water better than I can. In much the same mysterious way, perhaps, that he doesn't, of necessity, mind having something tightly tied around his neck, whereas I physically can't stand that. As his creator, of course, all such divergent tendencies, and especially physical ones, are a great source of fascination for me. Meanwhile, for all the attention anybody paid to this suiting up process, whether due to exaggerated politeness or whatever, Goblin Hood and I might just as well have been pissing off the top of that ladder into that big can. At any rate, the basement party was strictly Goblin Hood's show from this point onward. I ought to describe this party. It took place in a large basement room with a fairly low ceiling, just high enough for a fellow to stand atop a small ladder and piss into a big can. At one end of the room were steps leading upstairs, as well as a large, shadowy area containing a big and ungainly furnace, its seemingly tentacle bulk festooned at the top with myriad pipes or vents or something, looked vaguely Martian in the gloom, or like some grotesque Lovecraftian tree monster. The big piss can, meanwhile, was located in this dark area, perhaps escaping general notice that way. At the basement's other end, at least 40 feet or so away, was a long picnic-type table facing the furnace region across the room. Food was being served here. Oddly, people sat only on one side of the table, with their eyes directed toward that furnace area where I'd lately been so unobtrusively relieving myself into that big can. It's truly a wonder that nobody had noticed, but then the space between furnace and table was filled with people milling about. Most were pretty vague and nebulous to me, but in general they seemed to be Goblinhood's friends rather than people that we both knew, either in the dream or out of it. They represented folks who had met G.H. reading tarot cards, or working the door at some performance venue, or just hanging out at some gallery or event. Hence, they only knew him as himself, and not as just some mere extension of the artist beneath his mask, beneath the mask. Goblinhood, needless to say, sort of prizes such people as choice friends. If they can even stand to be around him in his mask without trying to argue or bully him into taking it off. The equivalent of peeling his face off. He's always set great store by anyone who can accept him at face value and let him be himself. And Goblinhood realizes something that others might realize if their shallow, petty interests went beyond claiming my face as some kind of conquered territory. It's this, that beneath the mask is yet another mask, a mask of flesh, another artificial construct, the public side of myself that is all I'll let other people see, particularly under duress. And it's as carefully contrived as Goblinhood, but more reserved, giving away as little as possible. Whereas Goblinhood will actually be himself when he gets the chance. So unmasking Goblinhood tells people really nothing at all, except what my face looks like at a given time, which, under the circumstances, is a little like people childishly demanding to be shown what someone's privates look like, and equally uninformative. The strangest thing about this party was the bar, situated about midway along one long wall. Between furnace area and table area was a typical looking small bar, sans stools or anything, but a recognizable bar nonetheless. Only the bartender wasn't dispensing drinks, he was handing out packs of various brands of cigarettes. G.H. accepted a couple of packs, little knowing, or rather not knowing at all, how important these smokes would become by the end of the dream. But even now, they were far better than him having to roll his own cigarettes, as usual, out of the regular-sized can of tobacco in his duffel bag. There must have also been a beer keg around somewhere, too, because the colorful caped carouser could be seen theatrically and enigmatically belting down glass after glass of the stuff to little ill effect. He's mostly always held his liquor better than I do, and usually even seems to escape the throbbing headache that even a couple of beers almost invariably imposes on me. Stronger medicine than beer was also circulating among the merrymakers. Among other things, for instance, Goblinhood got to toss down a couple of fiery snorts of damned good brandy from somebody's classic silver hip flask. Chasing these with beer, he wondered about that cigarette bar. The hip flask had reminded him of Prohibition, when such dodges for hiding booze were common accoutrements. And he wondered if tobacco products had finally been outlawed in this dream, which would make the whole party a kind of speakeasy for cancer sticks, a smoke-easy, if you will. He also wondered if the cops upstairs could smell the smoke, or were they themselves sucking on hopelessly ornate meerschaum pipes, or stuffing fat, smelly, feculent cigars in their grim and humorless mugs? None of these questions were ever exactly answered. Much of the party conversation was just shy of being coherent enough for questions to be answered and the like anyway. As is the case with many parties, the talk largely consisted of inane yammerings and drunken burblings, with the occasional truly witty bon mot standing out like a jewel in a dung heap, eliciting gales of sometimes barely comprehending laughter and often much distorted repetition. As for Goblinhood, his beer-assed idea of sparkling party small talk was to tell people they could call him G.H., his initials, even though his name is both spoken and written as one word, and then to tell those same people that the G.H. is silent, as in the word through. Yuck, 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 and a million guffaws, am I right? Goblinhood likes to think of that as one of his Martian jokes, but most people probably take it as just some addlepated non sequitur or worse. Be all that as it may, at some point Goblinhood evidently thought the party had reached a peak of hilarity or something, and he decided to break out his sidekicks, the Suitcase and Cosmic Weevil dolls, from their cloistered retreat in the Goblinhood duffel bag, so that they too could enjoy all the fun. This is a more or less standard practice for Goblinhood at parties, in dreams or otherwise. But right away he noticed an unforeseen problem. The little handmade suitcase doll, whose handle section had been missing for years, was also now missing both legs and an arm. Out here in real life, in recent Free Press, Goblinhood comics and the like, Suitcase had been getting depicted with the handle anyway, and the hell with it. But this new configuration was obviously harder to gloss over, even in a dream. Jeepers, thought Goblinhood, everything's falling into abysmal rack and ruin. Is this an isolated incident or a fearsome harbinger of global or even universal doom? Good question. Not wishing to dwell on it, he gave the dolls a quick and rather peremptory look-see at the surrounding partyscape and then tucked them away again. Perhaps in view of the alarming circumstances, he didn't even check to see if he had his celebrated handmade tarot cards along, nor did he speculate on their possible state of intactness. But he couldn't help wondering just what kind of a fracas the suitcase doll had gotten itself into while he wasn't looking, and against who or what had the once formidable doll been contending. Like so many other questions here, this one also remained an utterly impenetrable mystery. Goblin Hood eventually found himself seated at the table, scarfing down some of the delicious food, which consisted of spicy hot stir-fry vegetables with rice and even hotter chicken wings. I'm no chicken fan myself, but Goblin Hood's tastes sometimes differ from mine, although we both draw the line at octopus-flavored anything. Besides, in this case, he sort of got off on rending the chicken wings asunder with his bare hands like some barbarian in a spaghetti epic. Generally speaking, unlike me, Goblin Hood actually enjoys eating in public and considers it as part of the act. So picture a sort of Last Supper tableau, in whose center the caked carnivore sat moodily staring at something across the room. It wasn't the furnace. And tearing chicken wings to shreds on his plate, and occasionally even eating some of the shreds. By this time, G.H. was slurping down glass after glass of refreshing Tootsie Pop Punch, an alcoholic drink that tasted sort of like a Tootsie Pop, tart and fruity outside with a chocolatey mess inside. Creme de cacao was a key ingredient. Goblin Hood was sitting next to a friend and colleague of his, a painter and filmmaker who is, in reality, currently directing a film, an independent production, to say the least, which stars none other than, of all people, Goblin Hood himself. So those two filmsters were jabbering and blabbering away at each other about their cinematic project in all its esoteric glory, very likely to the confusion of anyone who overheard them. Other table talk, however, centered around the goings-on at the other party on high, the one where badges and billy clubs were no doubt de rigueur. Rumor had it that that notorious masked scalawag, Goblin Hood, alias G.H., was becoming a hot topic, more than a mere conversation piece, at the confabulation of cops upstairs. According to witnesses, pilgrims perhaps to and from the bathroom. Rabid officers of the law barked and snapped tersely at each other up there, linking G.H. to berserk conspiracy theories involving everything from the Oklahoma City bombing to the hole in the ozone layer. The Martian hole in our ozone layer, stridently insisted one particularly hard-bitten specimen, whose rampant paranoia evidently knew not even planetary bounds. It was all bosh and twaddle, of course, with a side order of rubbish and balderdash, and the whole mess temptingly smothered in bilge and poppycock sauce. The only thing that Goblin Hood was technically guilty of was smirking around behind his harmless mask and trying to get away with being who he was. But try telling that to those cops now, who were probably up there porking out on beer and pig's knuckles with sauerkraut or some other less than appetizing species of cop-type food, no doubt belching huge, fetid gusts of horrible, beery, porky, knuckly, crowdy breath in each other's gruff but stern faces, pissing each other off, getting each other good and mad, and then playing a quick 9 rounds of blame it all on goblinhood, the game in which goblinhood gets blamed for virtually anything and everything. But that didn't keep them all from being a bunch of assholes and dickheads. In any case, maybe they've been sneaking downstairs and checking out samples of that giant urine specimen down there, just to see how bad things really were, with perhaps unsettling results. As for the further progress of ye old basement soiree, I read somewhere that a Samoan party isn't considered successful until after someone spills a drink, or breaks a plate, or kisses the wrong someone else's spouse, or something like that. An embarrassing little human blunder amidst all the merriment and jollity. Maybe it's sort of akin to the way an Islamic carpet maker supposedly leaves a deliberate small flaw in the work to honor the exclusive perfection of Allah or something. I read that too. Well, a goblinhood party isn't official until someone starts whimpering and whining about the mask, or so it would seem, and all too soon that dreadful time came around again, and yet another tough customer failed at length to entice or to browbeat goblinhood out of the mask, the way Billy the Kid might have failed to put a new hole into Pat Garrett's head. But this latest contender was miffed at goblinhood's steadfast intransigence and, with malice aforethought, began spitefully to actually threaten goblinhood with the latest glad tidings from above. More bad news, that is, from the upstairs constabulary carnival. It seems that all those cops by this time had unanimously decided to arrest goblinhood out of hand the very next time any of them saw him running around loose on the street. They reasoned, if that's the right word, that anyone who dressed as weird as goblinhood must be carrying a lot of illegal drugs around at all times. I think that's cheerfully thought of as a species of probable cause or something in certain boneheaded cop circles. Of course, this asinine little plan was doomed to eventual failure when it would ultimately turn out that nobody dressed as weird as goblinhood would be foolish enough to carry lots of illegal drugs around at any time. Nobody in their right mind, anyway. I mean, come on. Still, the strategy in question could provide the truculent gendarmerie with golden opportunities aplenty to just jerk goblinhood around endlessly for the sake of the sheer nuisance value alone, which wasn't, of course, something for him to look forward to. So one certainly might have expected G.H. to meet this dismal news with a stirring speech about freedom of expression, or even a drum-thumping call to arms against police state oppression and so forth. But by this stage of the game, goblinhood could only shrug and hunch himself wearily over his fruity, chocolatey tipple and blurrily mumble, "Jesus, what a bunch of fucking spoil sports." Now, I wouldn't want to give the impression that that bunch of fucking spoil sports had managed to totally buffalo the old gobster with their big talk about following a bold new policy of deliberate and incessant harassment where he was concerned. But for some reason, it transpired that I was back in my street clothes when I finally left the party house, wondering bitterly if they'd try to bust me just for having the potential to become Goblinhood again if I wanted to. But I didn't have any trouble with them, as it turned out. I didn't have any illegal drugs on me either. Unless you wanted to count those cigarettes, which at least seemed to still be perfectly legal after all. So I smoked one of those while I contemplated the strangeness of the evening sky, which had turned sort of blood red. Despite the late hour, it was almost as bright as daylight out, albeit a ghastly and morbid-looking sort of daylight. Just then, apropos of nothing, I suddenly decided to walk a few blocks to a neighborhood bar that I sort of liked, and there to begin deliberately drinking myself to death like Alexander of Macedonia is popularly supposed to have done at the end of his conquests. At the moment, I couldn't have articulated a valid reason for this rather odd decision, but I think now that the dream version of me had begun to dimly realize what the fate of his own world was soon to be, nothing, it seems, is as fragile as the full-fledged but short-lived universe in which a dream takes place. And I've known this for a long time, like everybody else to some extent, I suppose. But in my case, I've thought about it a lot, and even long since written about it, and also, at times, dreamed about it. So I probably suspected that his hour number was up, was almost up, and wanted to get downright stupid out before the curtain rang down a different kind of oblivion, one sporting a far more permanent character. In any case, it's probably no accident that my dream self was now trudging resignedly toward a really spiffy local watering hole called the Dreams and Apocalypso Bar and Grill. And a funny thing happened to me there in the dream during my morose little trek to that bar. I almost got killed before I could even begin the terminal binge that I had in mind. As I was crossing a little side street, a car roared into it from a nearby main thoroughfare, evidently for the express purpose of running me over. Judging from the determined way that it zeroed in on me, but the woman driving it seemed to change her mind halfway to me, and with an intensely frustrated look on her face, as seen by me through the windshield, she backed frantically in the direction she'd come from and went speeding away on the one-way thoroughfare, in the wrong direction, as it happens. I know nothing whatsoever about her. As best I can tell, I'd never seen her before, neither here nor in the dream. She drove into and back out of my dream scenario with the air of an actress who discovers that she's wandered onto the wrong sound stage and then wastes no time in getting the hell out. but I can't help speculating about her now. Maybe she sensed what was coming. Maybe she thought that by killing me, so that I'd never wake up, I suppose, she could save this dream world from total destruction. Then maybe it occurred to her that killing me might end my dream and her universe on the spot. Maybe she drove off desperately hoping to find a safe place to hide out, some kind of refuge, when, sadly, no such convenient haven existed where she and all the other dream people could be truly safe from me. So she was last seen, whoever she was, driving pell-mell away from the site of her bungled assassination attempt, driving the wrong way on a one-way street in a situation where all the laws of nature and humanity were breaking down anyway. Hell, even the mighty suitcase couldn't seem to cut it around here anymore. Acting as if nothing too weird had just happened, I continued on my doleful way in the increasingly forbidding red light of what should have been darkness. And I can't help still wondering now about that woman's seeming attitude towards me. If I'm right in my speculative interpretation, then it seems to cast a new light, perhaps a red light, over the behavior of all these dream inhabitants. Those irascible cops, for instance, if they'd known what that woman seemed to know about things, would they have stood down in their soi disant crusade against goblinhood? Or would they have been even more resolved to just do him right up at the first opportunity? And if so, would they have suddenly figured out what she seemed to figure out? Would they have realized that it might not be too good of an idea? Where were they now, for that matter, as I traversed the almost empty streets of my dream? Did they know the world was ending, and had they buggered off to spend the last moments with their families or something? Or were they all still back there partying, indulging themselves in a kind of plague year dance of death, a weird doomsday capriccio? These questions are unanswerable now. I only know that the cops never showed back up in the dream. Hell, technically, they'd never had the brass to show their faces at all. And since they were, technically, the only reason why I wasn't wearing the mask and being goblinhood on my journey, I'm going to do something now that I've never before done as a dream chronicler. I'm going to just assume that my dream self got tired of worrying about the absentee cops and put the goblinhood stuff back on anyway. After all, there was no specific indication that he didn't, and at least a few clues, including the ambiguous identity question at a certain point, which strongly suggest that he did. All of which goes to show how nebulous most of the dream's end was, particularly when it came to transitions. So why not include, ex cathedra, this important one involving goblinhood? Eh? This might just be the most appropriate procedure anyway. Though as clearly defined as I can get him to be, goblinhood remains, for most people, a vague and shadowy character, just as most of the rest of this dream right up to the spectacular ending, retains a vague and shadowy character, which is sort of odd, by the way, to someone who's been studying dreams as long as I have. Usually it gets fuzzier the farther back you go, and crisper toward the end of the dream, where events could be expected to stay right on the tip of your mind as you wake up. This dream's climax was certainly crisp, but paradoxically so were some of the earlier parts, which I might not have been expected to remember at all. In any case, Goblinhood's participation was what was most memorable to me about the dream's beginning, so he might as well be there to make the end memorable too, and to bridge the yawning gulf between those two poles, what we like to call the middle, where, it must be admitted, there wasn't much happening with the unmasked version of me, not since that vehicular near miss, anyway. And that isn't too surprising, since I go out of my way to make myself even more vague and nebulous than Goblinhood when I have to be around at all. And so, if nothing else, Goblinhood's participation in the rest of this should make my account more interesting, surely from a literary point of view. Then, too, there's a particular literary type of reason why he has to be involved. But we won't speak of that, if you don't mind. It's probably too subtle a point for most of you to catch anyway, or to grasp if you did, and I don't want to make the rest of you feel like dunces, okay? So let's just say that there are a lot of pragmatic reasons here for me to yell out, "This looks like a job for Goblinhood!" And of course, to put my money where my mouth is on that score. Besides, it comforts me. If I ever have to preside over the end of this world, I want to do it as Goblinhood. Partly because he's more appropriate of an image for some doomsday scenario, and partly because I know he tends to be more actually sympathetic towards other people than I can usually manage to be. When G.H. talks about preventing nuclear war, for instance, he really means it, even if he can't really feel it. Whereas I, in my worst moments, can't quite even manage to really mean it half the time, and even in my best moments, I find it hard to feel anything except pain, misery, anger, rage, disgust. I can still feel all of those, while those kinds of feelings are usually muted way down for Goblinhood. Meanwhile, my being Goblinhood could also comfort everybody else in the dream. He's easier to hate and to fear because he looks so little like one of them, the other humans inhabiting this dream. And I have no doubts whatsoever. I have no doubts whatever, by now, that they all knew who was responsible for the impending doom. They just didn't want to talk about it. Certainly their wisest course, in the face of their sheer helplessness, and one which, to my mind, created a touching impression of calm dignity on their part. And so it could easily be in their honor, or at least in their interests, that I should place Goblinhood amongst them, if only as an object for their detestation, if that's what they truly wanted. Damned polite of them, of course, not to just go ahead and actually treat him like that. But I won't write about goblinhood in the third person for this. Instead, I'll let the old gobster narrate the rest of his tale himself. If it gets confusing, well, things got pretty confused towards the end anyway. And what's the difference anyhow? Goblinhood is me too. And so was everybody else in the dream. I know that now. But that didn't keep them from all from being a bunch of assholes and dickheads. And it doesn't make this story any easier to tell, either. But here, I'll turn the rest of it over to Goblinhood. He likes telling stories, especially about himself. So in no time at all, I found myself languidly presiding over the end of the world from my lofty perch inside a dumpster, say the parking lot of the Dreams Inn Bar and Grill, surrounded by certified drug alcohol people in the form of a milling throng. This was no reign of terror either, though the sky seemed to be almost raining fire and brimstone. Drug alcohol people? I picked that little gem up while watching television one bored Sunday morning. A klutzy televangelist was sputtering semi-coherently about moral pitfalls, groping around for a term describing certain of the tempters of this world, finally settling for the drug alcohol people. And I had to laugh. He reminded me of the late great comedian Phil Hartman doing his hilarious Saturday Night Live version of an inarticulate drill sergeant yelling at a snickering soldier things like, "You think the army's just some big joke building?" And calling him haplessly Mr. Smiling, Laughing, Joking Around Man. Meanwhile, these drug alcohol people here in the parking lot were acting as if the whole universe was just some big joke building. And I guess it was, from their point of view. And guess what jolly jokester was the custodian of said structure? And guess what kind of mask that janitorial wag was sporting? And as for that dumpster, I don't know how I got there, but I know I wasn't in disgrace there. It's more like I was in state there, holding court in my mask and cape, sitting pretty behind my Swift Goblinhood ID tag, lounging elegantly about near the top of the dumpster, atop what turned out to be a small mountain of ice. Not cold, oddly, but not melting in this summer heat either, which was even odder still. But there I was, Goblinhood, the dumpster king, lord of the gutter snipes, grand wazoo of the drug alcohol people, as Frank Zappa might have put it. Yes, I was on the top of the heap there, among all my dissipated and dissolute peers, watching the universe die with a stupid smirk on my phiz. Not that any of those poor wretches were exactly my peers in decadence, you understand, but they were all sort of like peers of the realm, or what was left of it in this royal context. L'état, c'est moi. I am the state. Louis XIV, one time King of France, is supposed to have said that. But was it ever truer than in this situation right here? I think not. And I think they knew it too, those drug alcohol people roaming the parking lot. But I also believe the esteemed writer who once postulated that they didn't want to talk about it, as if talking about it could have done any of us any good anyway. We were done for, whether we knew it or not, whether we talked about it or not. You might wonder what we were all doing out there in the parking lot, but that's easy to explain. Aside from the spectacular night sky, there were fireworks coming up, or at least a kind of flying circus, what used to be called an air show, I guess, and nobody wanted to miss it. I myself, for instance, never saw the inside of the Dreams End Apocalypso Bar and Grill. No, I spent everybody's last moments enthroned in my regal dumpster outside, basking in the red chaos of cataclysm. You might wonder, too, just what exotic substance the drug alcohol people were so hopped up on out there. But the funny thing was that nobody was actually drinking or taking drugs. By this time, we were all way past that, locked into some terminal but ever-increasing hysteria. Maybe we were high on life, as the corny old anti-drug phrase has it. But I don't think so. I think it was more like that medieval dance of death again. Though we were all confirmed wastrels, we didn't, at this point, need anything stronger than our own adrenaline rushes, born of fear and ecstasy, and increasing as the end came ever closer. We were drunk, I think, on the sheer hopelessness, the sheer inevitability of it all. I was reminded of a scene from Eugene O'Neill's play, The Iceman Cometh, but in reverse. Towards the end of that play, a bunch of barflies who just want to get drunk and pass out complain that all the available booze has lost its kick. But here there was no booze at all anymore, only lots of ice. Yet this parking lot mob was busy spiraling upward into some kind of exalted delirium, and had probably forgotten that there ever was such a thing as passing out. In any case, if, as has been suggested, I'd truly set out to drink myself to death, I was making a piss-poor job of it. But the job was getting done anyway, at least insofar as inebriation was concerned. Finally, you might still be wondering, though my predecessor in these narrations has literally spelled it out, just what the hell I'm talking about with all this apocalypse stuff. Do I mean that this dream was about the end of the world? No, I mean this dream was the end of the world. In fact, every dream is the end of the world. I should have thought this was self-evident, but for those who haven't caught on yet, probably because they don't want to, I'll try to briefly explain. No, you don't have to thank me. Somebody, was it Robert Frost or Carl Sandburg, once wrote a famous poem about fire and ice and the end of the world. Well, here the sky may have only seemed aflame, and the ice may have just been some kind of a stage prop. It sure didn't act like real ice. But our world was ending just the same. It was ending because of the Red King's slumber. In Lewis Carroll's sequel to Alice in Wonderland, a book called Through the Looking Glass, Alice comes upon the Red King snoozing under a tree, tasseled nightcap and all. I think Alice was hanging out with those tetchy twins, Tweedledum and Tweedledee at this point, but whoever it was tells her that their whole looking glass world was just a dream the Red King was having, and that they dare not wake him up. I think Alice's response to this might have been along the time-honored Victorian lines of stuff and nonsense. But I noticed she wound up not waking him up. Probably her wisest course by far. And I guess you get the drift of this, like it or not. So there we all were, me and these so-called drug alcohol people, trapped in a real situation exactly like that, cavorting, you might say, in the court of the Crimson King, as the band King Crimson might have been pleased to put it. But I think an even deeper meaning lurks beneath the surface of this situation, at least for the dreamer in question and his current children of the night. Long before I existed, before this whole goblinhood routine was even a concept, my creator, the artist Beatty, whose wit and wisdom you've been soaking up a lot of if you've read this far, wrote and eventually illustrated and even sort of published a short story called Nightmares for the Yesterday People. It probably wasn't much of a story, as stories go, and I doubt if it could be regarded as having been very well written. It probably wasn't even this good, but it was interesting in certain ways, particularly in that the artist was actually trying to be scientific about a real phenomenon. In addition to all the Red King type stuff about dreams, Beatty's story dwelt on such matters as the notion, fact or fiction, that the human body completely regenerates itself every 7 years, and that, in his own words, not even The humblest micromolecule escapes changing irrevocably from microsecond to microsecond. Assuming, of course, that there even are such things as micromolecules. But physics was never Biotti's strong suit. I think the trend of this line of thought should be obvious. Biotti was seeking to undermine our notions of stability or even of reality for some obscure purpose of his own. To his credit, he even admitted the uselessness of this research when he said, "I have made a discovery. I am publishing my findings. A commendable enough undertaking, you might say. Yet consider this. My discovery, though probably of vast import, can be of no possible benefit or positive use to the human race. Indeed, it can only function to further traumatize my already psychotic society, possibly even helping to bring about the final, terminal desperation of the human spirit. A better man would keep the knowledge to himself." Indeed. Well, unfortunately, being a better man was never particularly Biotti's strong suit either. At least, not until I came along with my Marcion philosophy of harmlessness. On the other hand, Biotti's findings were published way back in 1981, and if the final, terminal desperation of the human spirit is in the cards, it's certainly taking its own sweet time about getting here. Which isn't even sarcasm, more like pity. Hardly anybody's ever even heard of Biotti's story, much less read it. So he apparently tossed his little bombshell into a crater that already went clear through the planet. Which is where I come in now. Biotti is apparently so enamored of his yesterday people concept that he wants me to dredge it back up here and explain it all over again. Apparently so he can take yet another crack at traumatizing his already psychotic society before he just packs it all in. Or maybe his reasons have changed by now. The original story characterized its own telling as a weakness of the condemned prisoner, a death row caprice. "Alone," says the story's narrator, "with no moral support, I am dying of this knowledge, and the horror of the situation is reflected in the fact that if I can, I am perfectly willing to take you all with me." Following which, the author comes right out and admits that he's busy writing a horror story. So it's little wonder that the Royal Academy of Sciences, or whoever, weren't exactly stopping the presses. That last bit of tortured prose also tells us a little about the author so willing to use any means of scaring people, and what's worse in my book, so willing to take everyone else with him. I hope to prove that Beatty has, in some ways, outgrown that last willingness in any case. But the question remains, what's he doing now? Why does he want to reiterate his yesterday people statement here? I mean, originally, that was the basis of a horror story, so his motive there was at least clear. But he isn't trying to scare people this time. I must confess that I don't know exactly what he is trying to do. Perhaps it's just that he thinks it's kind of a neat concept that he's got going here, especially because it's based on a kind of fact, and he can't bring himself to drop it, or even to have simply wasted it on a crappy horror story of yesteryear. Or maybe it's because the so-called yesterday people syndrome in question has to do with the nature of reality, or of human consciousness, or of existence, to be blunt. That might explain everything right there. He's been gibbering throughout these pages about different kinds of existence, and the current discussion would certainly seem to be related to that, as may be. All I want is to get the discussion over with. Part of Beatty's theory in the story Nightmares for the Yesterday People seemed to be that dreams are a real experience too, almost a different life in a different world, albeit not a physical one. But try telling that last to a somnambulist who, for instance, dreams that he's in some nebulous but dangerous place, and wakes up turning the light on downstairs, where he's sleepwalked down a hazardous flight of steps from his bed upstairs, in order, apparently, to belatedly feed his pet goldfish. At such a time, the dream world can at least seem downright physical. Okay, so dreams are real. Let's stipulate it. So what? Well, so the people we are in our dreams, they're real too. In fact, they're really us, aren't they? And what happens to those poor buggers every morning when we wake up from our dreams? A damned good thing that they don't feel pain like we do. Anyway, I think Beatty was trying to explain his own schizoid tendencies, or whatever they are, let alone to explain his lifelong fear of sleep, by showing how insubstantial human life really is, either waking or dreaming. He reminds me, regarding this attitude of his, of the character in Franz Kafka's story, Conversation with the Supplicant, who has to beat his head on the floor in church, and who later, with a dreamy book on his face, tells the story's narrator, "There has never been a time in which I have been convinced from within myself that I am alive." Well, you said it, Kafka, wherever you are now. According to Viotti's yesterday people theory, none of us really are alive. Or at least not in the bullheaded and self-assured way that we think we are. Things here change so fast that they can barely be said to have ever really existed at all. At best, each of us is alive for only one short day apiece, or, in the case of who we are in our dreams, for however long the given dream happens to last, usually minutes, I'm told, or even only seconds. The continuity we seem so sure of is only a cheering illusion that we foster because we couldn't live without it. But we do live, I guess, in however strange a state, though we may ask ourselves, as an example, what we were doing at a particular time on a given day, say, 30 years ago, if we've even been alive that long. And chances are we can't even remember for sure where we were on that day, at that time, except in the most general terms. Unless Kennedy was assassinated that day, or something else that caused what is sometimes known as flashbulb memory. As for what we were doing that day, at that time, what difference does it make now? Unless we were assassinating Kennedy just then, or doing something else that would drastically shape our future selves. The point is, where is that day? Where does it even exist now? If Viotti's stuff about bodily regeneration and micromolecules is correct at all, then that day and everyone who lived through it is dust now, if it's anything at all. And where? Even science tells us that our world has been traveling away from that particular point in space for 30 years. But even the people that we were only yesterday, where are they now? Maybe it doesn't matter. But still, that's our vaunted continuity for you. We're like spiders, leaving an outgrown exoskeleton behind, or snakes shedding our skins. Only we're doing that moment by moment, or microsecond by microsecond. And we're just darned lucky that we're so constituted as to be unaware of it. So Viotti was right, in a way. We are the yesterday people as we go along, and essentially all the time. We're the losers, the discarded folks, the ones that got left behind, the obsolete models, the people who aren't going to make it into the next millennium after all, who aren't even going to see the next sunrise. When it comes right down to it, you, the reader, aren't even going to be quite the same person that you are right now by the time you get to the end of this page. But though we're always yesterday people, we're never more that than we are in our dreams, where matter usually doesn't matter, where what we think we are is all that's important. And as for the other people in our dreams, what could they possibly think they are? Anyway, yeah, we're all toast, and we always were, and we always will be. None of us ever really gets to see, let alone to be, more than a tiny fragment of the vast tapestry that we call existence. But that doesn't mean we have to waste what pitiful and elusive of a life we do seem to have. And I think this dream was, in part, trying to tell me that. Author's note. I hate to intrude like this, but I need to point something out about goblinhood, whose rhetorical use of the word we has been so helpful during the preceding rant, at least for the purpose of clarity. When he says we, he's leaving out his own special status as an artificial life form. And he's doing that in order to state the case as clearly as possible. Given his own physical status as a mere mask, however, that is, as a seemingly inanimate object, the word we would probably signify something much broader to him than just the human race, which he doesn't necessarily even regard himself as a part of. From his own viewpoint, when he says something like, "Where is what we were yesterday?" he means everything in the universe, not only those conscious or sentient beings who happen to regard themselves as the only things of importance in the universe, which, however, doesn't really alter any of what he's just said. Meanwhile, one might expect a critter like goblinhood to experience a double-barreled version of this so-called yesterday people syndrome. But in fact, it isn't like that at all. He's simply there again every time I put the mask on, and he's glad to be there. And when I stop wearing the mask, it doesn't bother him, unless somebody forces him to stop. He's still there, somewhere, and he probably enjoys more continuity in terms of his personality and self-awareness than I do myself. The advantage of being an artificial life form, I guess. And remember, if goblinhood ever does abandon that rhetorical we and starts to rub your faces in his special status, he isn't being mean. He's just being weird. And it's the nature of the beast, however unnatural of a beast he may be. But let's get back to his narrative now, shall we? Because the hour groweth late. So anyway, you didn't exactly need tarot cards to know what was going to happen to all of us parking lot celebrants when the dreamer woke up. Yet, I was feeling pretty Olympian about everything, watching it all from my comfy dumpster there as if it were all only a movie or something. I suppose I felt that I was more real than all the others were. Felt that it would sort of be me who woke up. Based on experience, though, I had no real reason to think so. Instead, what was soon going to wake up and snuff us all, like so many candles in the wind and rain, would most likely be this bleary-minded curmudgeon, surly as a sore-assed bear until he guzzled down some coffee, who might not even remember to write this down when he woke up, in which case we really were lost, and our efforts all in vain. But just in case he did remember, we were ready for him. These yesterday people in the parking lot were evidently seasoned veterans where this thorny problem was concerned. They may have looked like a bunch of hysterical sots and misfits, but I'm convinced now that they were solemn and dedicated envoys from the dreamer's subconscious with important information to impart. Though, as is the case in most dreams, they were going about it a little strangely. But that doesn't make them a bunch of assholes and dickheads. It just made them a little strange. And in the end, aren't we all that? Easy for you to say, GH. Is that what you're thinking as you read this? But you've no idea how strange you'll be by the time you get to the end of this page. You don't even know how strange you are right now, to me anyway. Why, it's quite possible that you're a total stranger as far as I'm concerned, let alone one who might not even exist yet. But you don't hear me complaining, do you? And by the way, the GH is silent, as in the word through. Speaking of strangers, before I get back to the dream, I want to quote something from a book, because it will help clarify something that I have to talk about later on. I know you're probably sick to death of my glib quotes and quips by now, dear reader, but you don't have to finish reading this, you know. You can always just go to bed early while the big kids stay up and read what's left. The book in question is Robert A. Heinlein's novel, Stranger in a Strange Land, specifically the original version of it, as published back in the early 1960s. For what it's worth, the line I want to quote, for my money, one of Heinlein's few really profound statements and the best thing said in the book, wasn't even in the novel to begin with. If I remember correctly, that is, I couldn't find this particular line during the one time I ever read the recently published uncut edition of the novel. Ironically, I think it was something that Heinlein added in revision way back when. As may be, Viotti sometimes rereads the originally published version of this novel kind of obsessively in order to recreate a certain 1960s type of mood, I think. And he hasn't even been above cribbing some of the Martian stuff in it and adapting it to my own mythos, most notably in the seldom seen 1992 painting L'Envoi, and to a somewhat lesser extent in an unpublished novel called Goblinhood Satyricon, written by Beatty between 1994 and 95. But we both appreciate that one line that I'm talking about because we've both found it useful in evaluating our own emotions, such as they are, particularly in my case. Anyway, on page 345 of our paperback edition, Berkeley Medallion edition, March 1968, 34th printing, the biggest typical Heinleinian contentious loudmouth in the book, a clown named Jubal Harshaw, is pontificating on the subject of love, and he says this:
"Love is that condition in which the happiness of another person is essential to your own."
So there, I find that apt. Of course, it doesn't cover every type of love. I mean, you can love the sunset, or you can love your work, or you can even love a juicy steak. Beatty loves all of those, and I guess I do too. But those are among the easy things to love. When it comes to loving people, I'm highly suspicious of any form of love that doesn't include wanting them to be happy. That can also be slippery, though. Suppose, for example, that the human race could never be really happy until it had succeeded in destroying itself through some kind of apocalyptic orgy of what amounts to self-loathing and hatred. That was a plausible thought back during the so-called Cold War, and it was also a popular premise in a lot of science fiction stories. I don't want to get into a discussion of what is often called tough love right now, because I'm tired of hair splitting at this point. So I'll just say this: people can be extremely difficult to love, in my experience, and humanity itself can be almost impossible to love. And try doing either of those when you can hardly feel anything except various forms of agony. But I suspect that at least trying to love one another may be one of the only decent purposes that we have in this life, however you define this life. And I make that statement as the Frankensteinian creation of an artist whose early emotional life was so severely dysfunctional that he didn't even believe there really was such an emotion as love until he was in his mid-20s. He thought that it was just some crap, just some cruel bullshit that society had made up in order to sell garbage on television or to explain the overheated folder roll in romance novels, or even, God help us all, to make people like him through its apparent absence feel even more worthless than he already felt anyway. And for all I know, God help us all, he may even have been right. But I have to live as if the young Beati had been mistaken in this matter. Otherwise, I see no decent purpose of any kind to human consciousness, with all its weird complexities. After all, even a fucking spider can love a juicy steak, especially if that steak comes packaged in the form of some helpless insect. But one can only hope that the true horror of that is more or less lost on both participants of the transaction. Whereas the giant brain of what we call Homo sapiens is finely attuned to horror, spends, in fact, a lot of its time sifting through various horrors, looking for anything good at all. And yeah, before you have to remind me, love can hurt, I guess. It can be a great torment, I'm sure, and the more so, the more seriously you take the concept. What really is happiness, for example, particularly somebody else's, and how easy is it to have and to hold? It's hard enough for any of us to get through this experience here on Earth without having our hearts held hostage to someone else's outrageous fortune. But the real torment, as I see it, is to have to think that we're here on Earth for no purpose whatsoever. To have to think that our huge and complex minds are only there to torture us. To have to think that there's nothing inherently decent about